This is Shaping Places, the podcast where we meet the people helping to shape the world around us and ask them to reflect on the places that have shaped them. I'm Dave Erasmus, speaker, coach, and thinker, and I enjoy turning big questions into impactful projects for others. I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Mason, Head of Innovation and Skills at the Crown Estate, and together we work with The Conduit on impact and sustainability. Our guest today is Sammy Leslie, custodian of Castle Leslie Estate in County Monaghan. Nestled between Dublin and Belfast, set across 1,000 acres of woodland and lakes, the estate has been in the Leslie family since the 1600s. For the past 30 years, Sammy has been restoring and reimagining this heritage place into a thriving, future-facing enterprise. Today, we'll explore the estate's journey from 17th century roots to a modern preservation vision, how Sammy's blend of hospitality, heritage, homes and horses guides decision-making, and what purpose a large estate should serve for people, nature and place in the years ahead. Sammy Leslie, welcome to Shaping Places. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Lovely to be here.
I'm delighted we finally pulled it together. I've been awaiting this conversation for a while. Matt Mason, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks, Dave. How are you?
I'm very well. Yes, I'm appreciating very much carpe diem at the moment with a fragile family life. It makes you really appreciate every single day. So being a new dad is a new experience altogether.
Much braver than me. It always terrified me.
Well, it is terrifying, but it's also beautiful at the same time. We're a long way from New York, where we first met, Sammy.
Absolutely, in a random apartment during Climate Week.
And I was quite pleased to go, actually. I've never been to like a New York artist studio before. And then I realised, goodness, you're a lot closer to home than the other people I was meeting in New York. And we met back here in London. We had some lovely...
Soca. And rosé on the roof of the club here.
Exactly. And that was a sunnier day than it is today, unfortunately. I'm sorry about that, but... I've been so excited about having you back here to have this conversation with us in Shaping Places because your journey is so unique with Castle Leslie. And if I'm right, when we first met in New York, you had literally just signed to reassemble the puzzle pieces, the final part of bringing it back together. Is that correct? And tell us how that works before we delve back into the past.
Oh, absolutely. I'm the fifth of six kids. It's an unusual family with eight belief systems and probably eight nationalities. And I really wasn't the one expected to take on the estate. And we're on the border and during the Troubles, that was not an easy place to try and run a business or do anything. Dad did his best. He started with a nightclub in the 60s called Annabelle's on the Bog. And then the Troubles kicked off. So he survived by selling artwork and selling land within the family. And then when I came home at 21, it was about to be sold. And I just asked, could I have a crack at it? So I started a tea room. So I got a grant for £5,000 from our County Enterprise Board. I sold my dad's car when he was out of the country. Don't ask about the logbook. The car is no longer on the road. And then just started with there and bit by bit, sort of brought my family out one by one. And the last big chunk at the end of last year, along with the big farmyard, because that then allows us to do some really interesting projects. It puts the landmass back in enough of a block to do things.
And that's what really excited me was that you've got this heritage that hopefully we'll delve into. But you're also back at the start line, shall we say. And I know you've got some really interesting thoughts about where to take things. But before we go into the future, let's go way back into the past. How far back can you take us in your family and the land? And where does that get us to?
All families go back a long, long way. We're just lucky ours was documented. Hungarian mercenaries that came over to bring a young girl called Margaret to marry King Malcolm of Scotland in the 1000s. And he became her protector. He also married the king's sister. And they were given land in Scotland near Inch, which is now called Leslie. And they built a house there in 1070, which has been restored. Then in the 1600s, there was a rather gobby bishop called Bishop John Leslie, and they kept translating him to all sorts of places. And I find it fascinating that bishops raised private armies and went to battle. And he used to have a saying that he would say, "Dear God, please stand aside and let the might of man alone decide," and go into war, chop people's heads off and come back onto the pulpit on Sunday morning and become a practicing bishop again. Mm. So he raised a private army against Cromwell in Raphoe and Donegal in the 1600s. And the king said, "I'll make you Archbishop of Canterbury." And he went, "I just would love to retire. There's a lake on the edge of my diocese." And he bought it in 1664 with his reward of £2,000 and settled down with his young wife. Mm. And that's how we ended up in the most beautiful little corner of Ireland on the border called Glaslough, which means Green Lake. And it's just magical.
Paint the picture for us. Take us deep into Castle Leslie Estate. What are we looking at? What are we seeing?
Well, if you look at it from the outside now, you very much see hospitality. Mm. And there was very definite sort of plan to repurpose buildings or update the purpose of which they were for. End of the day, the castle was built to entertain. We just do it in a slightly different way. So from the tea rooms, we got 6 rooms in the castle. Mm. Then we got up to 14. Then we got ridiculously lucky because Paul McCartney married Heather Mills and his mother, Mary, is from Monaghan, our home county. Mother Mary, let it be. And that put us on the global map. Mm. And it was just about 5 years after the peace process. Mm. In my heart, I believe that it was his way of paying back to the county that he came from, because his wedding wasn't just about us. 800 million people saw it on television around the world, and it really helped identify Northern Ireland and the border counties as being safe to travel and a place to visit. So, you know, we kind of gone from a no-go zone almost right the way through to, you know, being voted best loved place to stay in Ireland 5 years in a row now in the public vote. So, big shift.
And in the estate itself, trees, lakes, 1,000 acres, I believe.
Yeah.
Many cottages.
7 gate lodges.
Yeah.
All different styles. They say they could never make their mind up. Mm-hmm. The gamekeeper is a fabulous old model farm, which we've just got back with ancient Dutch barns. The lodge, as it's called, was initially built as a dower house, but there was never a dowager. It was then the agent's house, and I bought that back in 2006. Mm. And then this is where now we've spent the last 2.5-3 years looking at really good examples around the country and abroad, going, what is the purpose of a big estate in the future? Mm-hmm. You know, it's certainly not for poncing around going, "Oh, this is all mine." Those days, thankfully, are long over. So what can we do in terms of projects on the edge around the Centre for Excellence for Autism, but also alongside that, social and care farming and rural respite? Can we build homes that are genuinely healing in that whole community? Everything is healing, rather than, you know, I take my child for an hour to somewhere where they get some therapy or intervention. You know, why can't it just be totally immersive? Mm. We're looking at an area around diaspora and famine memorial, and to do that whole piece of research, looking at restoring the walled garden and going, well, a walled garden was not just flowers and fruit. It was your perfumes, your scents. It was your entire apothecary. It was your poisons. It was your colours. It was your supermarket. And look at what we did and grew then, and how many plants we've actually lost, and how much knowledge about plants we've actually lost. And then the Big Green Box, working in a project with our tourist board as an immersive experience for visitors to help them understand in a fun way more about planet and plants and our relationship. But also love to do the educational piece, because quite often our policymakers don't have somewhere to learn more about how our planet works.
You've reeled off so many fascinating, diverse, interesting projects. And obviously it's a broad place covering your 4 H's and your, you know, all kinds of different actors within it. How do you hold together a sense of your mission, what you need to do in this interwoven, interconnected, you know, multifaceted space? Because it must be hard to keep hold of a clear vision as well as enable each of the different actors to do their wonderful individual thing.
It is. The way this estate is set up is that it's a preservation trust. They'll act as the guardians. They hopefully will be the guardians to make sure everybody stays online in the next 100 years. Hospitality works on the basis of social enterprise. I get a salary like everybody else. We also have set up a charitable foundation, which will carry out the majority of the projects. And I have my little garden shed, which is innovations. And that's where I hope even after I'm gone, there is always that sort of spirit of curiosity that anything is possible, that then you take through the process to make realities. So all I can do is set the structure up, bring good people on board, do that sort of master plan. And then, like anything, no matter how, you know, organized and linear you want to try and make it, it isn't, and things will change. And quite often it will be funding that decides which projects pop up to the fore.
But it's not a small thing. You've glossed over it very nicely, very quickly, as you would, but it's not a small thing what you've done. You've turned it from a mini monarchy to a democracy of some kind. Maybe not a democracy, but some kind of codified structure. You've individually chosen to put all of your private stuff into a structure that you no longer own or control.
May 10th next year is when we have the big day to go public with everything.
I know you wouldn't think of it too much like this, but it's millions of pounds worth of assets that you privately own, I assume now. And now you've put them into a structure to ensure their long-term flourishing effectively. And what possesses you to do that?
Oh, there's a lovely saying at home, they don't make pockets in shrouds. I don't believe in a sense of entitlement. I think it's probably one of the most dangerous things you can instill in a child. I think it's probably one of the most unfair and cruelest things you can do, because they don't learn a sense of reality and also all the coping mechanisms you need, because one day, you know, no matter how perfect your life is, it, something will go tits up, and that is a technical term. Come on, I'm a woman. I don't believe very much in the patriarchy either. I really do believe in meritocracy. So whoever steps forward with the skills and the want and the passion to do things, no matter how small or how large, gets embraced. And if that's a member of the family, wonderful, but more than likely it won't be. And it's being set up in that scenario. And if it's a member of the family, they have to be better than anybody else to get the job. There's no entitlement.
So it's a meritocracy, but essentially you and I assume some others have encoded the values into a structure. So what are those values that make it all hang together for you then?
Meritocracy. You get to do the job because you're good at it and you continually do the right thing. One of the fundamental ones is kindness. We've become very unkind to each other and very unkind to our planet. We seem to think we can wrestle it into submission. I think Mother Nature is very close to telling us to take a hike and go and find somewhere else to live. We need curiosity and critical thinking now more than ever. And also that constant ability to work things out as the world changes. It's being able to weave in some boundaries and some parameters and some guidelines and then let the magic happen and weave in between. You know, you can't rule from the grave.
Throughout your story, health is a large part of what I think you seek to help develop at the estate. What other ways have you interacted with health as a theme in your life and that of the estate?
I've all my life struggled with issues around food and digestion, and I'm only starting at 58 to get to the bottom of that. So I've always been fascinated in gut health and soil health and the connections throughout our body. In my early 40s, I developed breast cancer out of the blue. Still don't know, you know, the whys and what triggered it, and probably will never know. And I've always struggled with exhaustion through a lot of my life. And then the year after breast cancer, I got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, MS, which was like, ah, seriously, lads.
Come on.
So very aware that life can be both extremely delicate and extremely fragile and incredibly robust at the same time. And one of my very dear members of team, who was actually my general manager at the time, on April Fool's Day of all days, had played rugby that morning, was in the kitchen taking the mickey out of the other chefs, ran up a set of steps and dropped dead with a brain aneurysm, with the most beautiful wife and an 18-month-old baby who at the wake was going, daddy up, because that's how she got him up in the morning. So there is that balance between very aware of the fragility of life, and I want to make sure that I don't leave a shit show if something does happen, and that's a robustness and wanting to make sure things continue for the next 100 years. And I'd love to be here for the next 100 years to see them and annoy everybody, run my walking stick down railings. But yeah, none of us know what tomorrow will hold.
And one of the things that attracted me about working together with Matt on the Crown Estate, connecting conversations together, is because the Crown Estate has a really long-term mindset, which in modern society, dominated by capitalism or political cycles, is extremely hard to find, even in extraordinarily well-paid senior leaders. But I feel like without us even getting into the present day or where you're headed in your seventh generation, I already know from the way you tell your story that you share that same kind of long-term thinking, because your story doesn't begin with you. It starts all the way back there. Do you think that's true, firstly? And if so, do you find it easy to find others that think in that same way?
Oh, we would very much talk about a 100-year plan. But, you know, when you look at old land and fabulous old trees, 100 years isn't actually that long. You know, we've got a chestnut tree at home outside the lodge, which, you know, the girth of which would fill this room has to be 350, 400 years old, which puts it earlier than almost any building around. And I love that fact. That tree will hopefully be there for, you know, another 100, 150 years. So in one way, 100 years is a very short period of time. At the rate we're mucking up our planet, it's a very long time. Mm. Things are changing so fast and starting to get to some very scary points.
Mm. 400 years is your time frame, isn't it, Matt? Isn't that what they talk about at the Crown Estate?
Yeah, we have oak trees in Windsor Great Park that meet the criteria as ancient oaks when William the Conqueror rode through in 1066. So it's funny you reference trees, and actually it's come up in other episodes of the podcast, but I always find those trees a great reminder of the kind of longevity of nature versus the brief moment in time that we're occupying the same space.
And then going on then from there, from school, where did your journey wander you?
Ooh, horses have always been part of the family. They are incredible teachers and incredible healers as well. You know, horses have been part of the human life in the last 5,500 years. And I think that's part of why now I'm so fascinated by our interaction with them, and especially for children with needs and other areas, other societal issues. But at 15, they were wonderful to work with. They didn't read, write, or speak English. You know, it was fantastic. And they're very logical in how they learn. And remember, we can take a baby horse right the way through from being totally untouched to an Olympic champion. So their capacity to learn is phenomenal. And you look at the number of different sports that they're in, but you also then start to look at all the different areas that they work in therapy as well. They're incredible teachers.
So you mentioned using the estate and horses as a way of escaping school and avoiding school. So what was little Sammy doing instead of sitting in a classroom at that time?
Ooh, a number of things. Either down in the yard working with the horses. And again, it's just sort of the sound and the smell and their breath and being with them. Taking my shoes off and walking barefoot anywhere and everywhere, that feel of warm soil and grass in your feet and mud squelching between your toes. Taking the majority of my clothes off, and quite often, sometimes all of them at midnight on a full moon, and getting into the lake and swimming. And there is just something about fresh water when it's that perfect temperature and almost silken, and swimming on a full moon is not recommended, but it is incredibly magical. And for me, it's also the sounds. Dad was a wonderful dad. As kids, we used to do things like he'd take us down to the ice house because there was a dragon that lived in the bottom of it. And you fed dragons fire. I mean, of course they eat fire. What else would they eat? And he would roll up balls of newspaper and light them and drop them down into this huge pit to feed the dragons. And as for kids, we were convinced we had dragons. And on the top of the big hill, there's an old water system, and the pump used to pump the water up to the tanks at the top for the town water. We didn't know that, of course, as kids, but you could sit at the hill at a point and hear the ba-bum, ba-bum, pa-pum, which we were told was the heartbeat of the mountain. Mm-hmm. So he was wonderful at telling stories like that. And for us, we have about 20, 25,000 rooks, and they will come in the dawn and the dusk, and just the sound of them is incredible, especially if you're in a boat in the middle of the lake when they do their evening flights. And I think probably one that I don't think sadly happens anymore, and a real reflection on climate, is the whooper swans coming in. Mm. And because the castle sits high overlooking three incredible lakes on the estate, and the main lake's about a mile long, and the migrating whoopers would come in and they would fly down in a large flock to land on the lake, and they would come below the level of the window of the house, and Dad would wake us up again, often when there was a full moon, drag us out of bed and open all the windows and shutters in the green bedroom, and you would stand in the moonlight and you would listen to the whoopers come in, and that incredible sound and them hitting the water. And then our pair of swans swanning down and going, "Go away!" And they'd all lift and they would do it again. But that magical, magical sound of the swans coming in the middle of the night. But yeah. What an incredible thing for a parent to do, to get the kids out of bed in the middle of the night to listen to it. Yeah, it's the sounds when you stop and you listen to nature. It's an incredible orchestra.
Love that. I was lost with that. You took me there.
Oh, I just wish we'd had film in those days. Yeah. And of course, the whoopers don't come through anymore.
Yeah.
So getting into like horse whispering, I'm going to call it.
I'm going to kick your shins under the table.
I think that's a compliment. I mean, is it a bad thing to say?
No, it's not. It's not at all. It's more they whisper to us too.
So let's talk about that, because I'm fascinated. When I was doing a set of dialogues into listening, somebody told me you need to speak to a horse whisperer. That's why I use the term. And so I think there's probably something to be learned there. But then to go into hotel management and stuff, that's quite a different shift. Was one a labour of love, let's say, because you obviously excelled at that very quickly. And was the other also a labour of love, or was it a strategic choice to sort of yin and yang your experience to set you upright?
I think I always knew I needed what we call the four H's, which was hospitality, heritage, homes. I've built some houses over the years, and horses. Mm-hmm. Horses and hospitality are very much about logic and consistency. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of sort of crossovers, but I just knew it would take all four areas. I mean, to make enough money out of horses to be able to restore the estate and to buy all the bits back was never going to happen. Mm-hmm. And we're doing a gazetteer at the moment with a wonderful conservation architect called Dawson Stelfox to work out what we've done to date, the number of buildings, what we've sort of spent to date, and what we've got to do to finish the estate. So in a funny way, after 35 years, I'm back to the start line.
Would you mind me asking what a gazetteer is?
I had to ask the same thing. I thought it was a gaslight. It's a document that talks about all of the different buildings, their size, their shape, their purpose, their current status, and then what it would take to restore them back up to standard where we can do something with them. And we are using as a pricing model what a government agency would spend, which for us tends to be a much higher budget because they tend to have the budgets. So it's going to be a very interesting exercise and a very large scary figure.
What is it then about the relationship that we can learn through listening to horses and letting them whisper to us?
I think if you strip it right back, I think one, we forget we've an old brain in a new world. Mm-hmm. Two, we forget that we're prey animals. We assume because we've got disposable thumbs and we've created all this amazing tech, our brain is still not wired as a prey animal. And prey animals are herd animals as well. And in herds, there will always be one animal that's sentient and watching to make sure there's any sense of danger. And at the end of the day, the human brain is hardwired to stay safe. That's its primary function. Mm-hmm. After that, it gets into, you know, nutrition and reproduction, and then we start to look at social and all the other ways our brain evolves. But our amygdala is hardwired to, if there's a sense of danger, it's high cortisol, high adrenaline, get the fudge cakes out of there, stop smelling the daisies, just leg it. And so much of our world creates that sort of levels of stress, especially for children with autism. Quite often they're locked into that fight or flight. You know, the four reactions are fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. And with horses being herd animals as well, they have to be able to hear each other as such. When one horse goes, there's a problem, he doesn't make a sound. Mm-hmm. He just changes his body language and his heart rate changes. Mm. Their hearts are 10 times bigger than ours. The electrical magnetic field around their hearts is 10 times stronger. So when one horse senses danger, the rest of the horses go and they're out of there. Our heart rate is obviously 10 times smaller, but when you're working with a horse and they're in a calm state, we pick up on that and our heart rate will drop to a point where it's calm. And it's only when our brain is in a calm, relaxed state that it's in that learning, open, curious state. And that's where you get the brain growth and you get the development and more synapses growing and forming. So they take us to that state when we work with them and we allow them to. And their heart rate is a 3-4 rhythm. And we write our lullabies in 3-4. So it's fascinating how calming they can be. And when you work with the trained therapy horses, that's where their heart rate is.
Well, you've articulated that beautifully.
And I think one of the amazing roles that large estates can play is in stewarding the land and playing a role in how we live with that land, because it plays such an important role in feeding humanity. We're realizing that if you mess with the land and you mess with soil, then you suffer the consequences. I know that you have thought about that in Castle Leslie and done work, and it would be great to kind of spend a bit of time talking about that.
It's wonderful having the dreams to create utopia, but it still has to be self-sustaining. You know, either you're a government body and you get state money, or you're a self-sustaining organisation as a not-for-profit or a social enterprise to do it. So, yes, you can ask me this question again on the 10th of May when we figured out how to weave all these amazing ways of thinking together, but they all have a commonality in looking after soil, healthy soil, a healthy nutrition, dense foods, a healthy gut helps healthy humans, and the cycle continues.
To get a bit more artistic for a second, let's fast forward a little bit. 30 years later, 100 years later, you and whoever else is
meritocratically.
Thank you. Whoever else is meritocratically chosen to help lead. Let's say it's a raving success. Everything you want to flourish, flourishes. People come, they see what's there. They think, I can do that where I am. And it spreads. Just help us imagine, what does that place look like, feel like, smell like, taste like, if all your various strands of woven projects actually come together and work?
Oh, I think it's quiet and loud at the same time. Loud because there's so much biodiversity thriving. You hear the bird song and the buzz of the insects and, you know, the roar of the deer. Quiet and peaceful in that all you do hear is nature. Very busy in some places, but totally open-minded and free thinking. We haven't got all the answers. All we can do is set up places and platforms for people to do different things. You know, I am probably the least qualified person around to do any of this. It's attracting, you know, the best and the great talent and people that are passionate about making the world a better place. Maybe I'm totally raving lunatic and nobody else is really interested. But I took a lot of solace from the Guardian survey recently about the silent majority, where they looked at countries around the world to ask how many people were seriously interested in climate and biodiversity, but thought they were the only ones and never really spoke up because they thought other people would think they were stupid and the only oddity in the room. And the stats came out between 80 and 89%, depending on the country, thought they are the silent majority. So how do we tap into that? I hope home becomes a place of inspiration that gives people advocacy and a voice to stand up and make the changes. Because one little corner of Ireland, no matter how wonderful and beautiful, can't do it all. You know, can we be part of the catalyst?
Sammy, is there anything else that you want to share with our audience, with us, whilst you're here?
No, just come and see us. If anybody out there wants to be part of it, let us know.
And there's so many projects that people can probably volunteer with and help with and get involved in and support in various ways, as well as maybe coming and having a right old party at the house.
Exactly. Exactly.
How would someone do that? How do they find you or get in contact with you?
If you want to find us, Google Castle Leslie Estate. Everything about hospitality is up online. A lot of the things we've talked about aren't really online just yet. Early next year is where we hope to go big and bold and loud and proud about it. My email is there. Contact us if you'd like to be part of it in any way, no matter how small or how big. As I say, we're fellow human beings on a shared place and a shared space. And the more people that become part of it and hopefully become part of trying to make our world a better place before we really muck it up, go, well, welcome with open arms.
I hope you don't mind me saying, but in the number of conversations that we've had so far, hopefully just the beginning of many more, some raucous, I hope. But you strike me as a very sensitive and also somebody that invites intimacy. I think maybe that's the horse stuff. There's an intimacy there, and there's a sensitivity there, and a selflessness that comes with the custodian mindset that I think that you've talked about. And I think it really excites and encourages me that somebody like you has been able to assemble the pieces to bring wholeness to a place in order to, you know, set it off for the next 500 years or whatever it might be. And I feel that that's in the very nature of who you are and how you've reassembled the pieces. I find it a real inspiration and hope that others take heart from that, that it's possible and that thoughtful, kind, sensitive people are leading the way on land and finding ways to create space for the future. So just thanks and well done for managing to do it. It's not easy to get all those pieces together and pull it off. So I'm just amazed by it, really.
Well, thank you. I mean, we are only at the beginning. Again, it's going to be a really interesting journey. And I'm not perfect like everybody else. I can be a thundering wagon on a bad day. So that point, no, I'm too tired. Yeah. But it's exciting and daunting. And there's still so much to learn.
Well, we're excited to figure it out with you and come and see what's going on. Thanks so much for coming in today.
No, well, they say in Ireland, the door is always open and the kettle is always on. So never be a stranger. And if you're in our parts of the woods, please reach out and come and say hello.
I look forward to joining you at your table. Thanks very much. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Dave.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for listening to Shaping Places from The Conduit and The Crown Estate. If you've enjoyed the conversation, follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. For any links or resources mentioned today, check the show notes in your podcast app. I'm Dave Erasmus with Matt Mason, and we record at The Conduit in London. Until next time, take care of yourselves and look after each other.